I'm James M. Lawson, Jr. I am United Methodist pastor who is not in a pulpit for the reason that I've retired from the pulpit, but I've continued to be actively engaged in teaching, and my history includes a long kinship with Martin Luther King Jr. in the struggles of the 1960s.
Okay, so let's start there in the 1960s. And this is an opinion, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of people would say that since the 1960s, or perhaps the early 1970s, we haven't really seen in the U.S. a massive, effective mobilization that worked on really any issue. I guess, obviously, do you think that's true? And if so, how come?
Yes, and there are other people who acknowledge that. Harrison Ford, the actor, has been involved in environmental issues for I'm not sure how many years, but in the January Sky magazine, which is the Delta Airlines magazine, he has a conversation with Bill Ford, the chairman of Ford Motor Company, who also has been involved in environmental issues, and the two of them have been on common missions together around the world. Towards the end of this piece, Harrison Ford says something like this: I am seeing the failure of the environmental movement because of the way in which we work, from issue to issue, species to species. Then he said what the environmental movement needs is a movement like the civil rights movement of some years ago. So I would say to you, what he is saying, what lots of people, you can say the peace movement has failed. I would say that such mobilizations as like at Democratic or Republican conventions in which I've participated, or Seattle, or some of the demonstrations, some of the mobilizations that the anti-Vietnam, anti-Iraq war has tried to do, have also failed. That what is needed is what I call a protracted struggle, organizing around nonviolent assessment, investigation, focusing in on a target, and then a protracted struggle with maybe a decade or two decades of intense activity that does not depend upon congressional legislation being passed, but rather forces upon a city or a nation the agenda of justice and truth.
So it sounds like one suggestion you have is to force local governments to respond rather than the national government. I mean, what other tactics are missing?
Well, I think all action has to be local action, but local action can become national action if it's local action that strikes the ethos of the American people in such a fashion that it will be imitated in many other centers of movement.
And now, what about, I guess you kind of referred to this at the end, but it sounds like you don't think there is a modern-day equivalent of the civil rights movement, right?
Not at all. Not at all. There's no modern-day equivalent of the civil rights movement.
What do you say to those who try to say, oh, the immigrants' rights movement is the equivalent, or the gay rights movement is the equivalent?
Gay rights movement is mostly a lobbying, getting laws passed, It is not a movement where there are tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people in the street who are demanding change or demanding justice with an agenda that they put on the nation's mind. So that's not what they're doing. They're doing much more lobbying behind the scenes, trying to stop some elections, which they have not done that successfully. So it is not a nonviolent movement, and it's not been that effective in my judgment.
And do you think these movements aren't effective because they aren't trying? Do you think the right strategy exists and they're refusing to see it, or
no,
they just haven't found it?
I don't think they have the right strategy. I think in the first instance they're not working from a nonviolent perspective and methodology, theory and practice. Secondly, they're not taking the time to assess what they need to be doing or what needs to be corrected, and then settling on a single issue out of that and working on it. And thirdly, they're not mobilizing in terms of direct mass direct action that dramatizes the issue and helps to change the public mind, both about the wrong and about the possibility of correction or restructuring or reform or transformation. I think there is far more action today than we had in 1953. Or 1955 or 1959. But I think that far more action over greater numbers of issues has failed, one, because of the lack of serious nonviolent study and commitment and processing, including a serious study of the freedom movement of the Southeast and its nonviolence, including a study of Gandhi, methodology and all. But secondly, it has been a failure because it has not even persuaded some of the activist leaders that there is a connection between, for example, racism and sexism. The women's movement cannot decide that they will have to perhaps abandon major white male demands of domination and control and abandon their racism if they're going to get at the problem of sexism. That racism and sexism and violence and plantation capitalism are interrelated to each other. In other words, what the principle of what I call convergence, in which in the movement, King suggested this, Dr. King suggested this, there was a gradual awareness that you had the issues of racism, as he called it, you had the issues of poverty, which is a part of what racism is, structural poverty, that's what slavery was, and the issue of militarization of the nation. And his sense that all three of these had to be dismantled in order for a new democratic society of justice and truth to emerge. Well, all through American history, there has been an inability on the part of all sorts of reformers to see the connection between the reform they want, let's say labor unions, and racism. Or racism and sexism, or sexism and the violence of the society. They've not been able to see these interlocking. They have not been able to see them as twin or parallel systems of denial and oppression for some people, and therefore recognize that they cannot resolve them separately, that any effective work against racism is going to also dismantle sexism, that any effective work for racism and sexism will dismantle the structural forms as well as the spiritual forms of violence, and must.
So is the Poor People's Campaign that Dr. King was working on, is that an example of convergence where he was trying to bring, was that convergence, had it happened already, or was it beginning to happen at that point?
He was very clearly trying to get the peace movement to see that the issues of poverty, economic deprivation, are connected to the issues of justice, which is connected clearly to the issue of peace. So it was a form of the emerging convergence that he recognized, that many of us recognize, in the movement of which he was the symbol. Yes, it was the part of the early beginning stages. Although I have to say that I made some of those connections in as early as 1958 in my workshops for SCLC, for SNCC, for other groups around the Southeast.
I know you mentioned this during the panel discussion, but could you briefly just, what is plantation capitalism? You mentioned that a minute ago.
Well, I maintain that capitalism in the United States began essentially through the taking of the land from the Indian, compounded then by 250 years of plantations, slavery, the worker as commodity and property and not as human being. And thirdly, by the way in which the Constitution treated issues of the woman in American society, that it was plantation capitalism that solidified racism and made it a system. Plantation capitalism, therefore, is the repetition of the theory of those eras in terms of economics and business and workers and profits and the use of capital. So where over the last 20 years, the more than 50% of the new jobs that Republicans and Democrats have bragged about have been poverty jobs, where we applaud, among other things, a surplus labor force because it keeps the wages down. Now, where wages are poor, so that workers cannot sustain themselves or their families, cannot therefore be that influential in their neighborhoods about their own environment, that is a direct linkage with the 250 years of slavery. Where the Wall Street Journal insists upon a major goal for the economy is to help people become billionaires and millionaires. That's an accumulation of wealth that means that in order to gather that wealth quickly or even in over a 10-year period, you must fight to see to it that the workers are not sharing in the benefits of their labor. So all of that is what I describe as plantation capitalism. When you allow wealth to accumulate in such a way that you drive out family-owned businesses and farms and you produce these huge corporations that in many ways are unmanageable, but who dictate the notion that the major purpose for our corporation is turning a profit and growing that profit, you have what I think to be plantation capitalism.
What would you say? I don't think I heard you mention the word prisons. Where does that fit into all this? Because I think certainly there were problems of black people being thrown in prison when you were doing your early work, but not to the extent that there is today. It's just exploded.
Yes. There's no doubt that the prison industrial complex, the whole development of private prisons, is really spiritually and theoretically a continuation of slavery. And again, it's also the demand of Wall Street that all human activity requires a profit, requires rather cost, and all cost of human activity ought to provide a profit to somebody, to entrepreneurs. Now, I differ with this tremendously. I think that in case, for example, of my medical dollar, that ought to provide a good living for all the people connected with the practice of medicine, including the janitors, the people who scrub the floors, who scrub out the laboratories, all the people, the doctors, the nurses, the paramedical people, the lab, all of those people. But I do not believe that my health dollar should be used to make a family that uses venture capitalism to buy up hospitals millionaires. I don't mind folk who become very affluent and wealthy in various ways in our economy, but I do mind where that's at the expense of the folk who do the labor, who do the work. And our society is in trouble because we have a whole lot of work that we need to do, like the infrastructures, the potholes, the repair of sewers and bridges and a whole range of things, the cleaning up of the environment, the cleaning up of our streets. We have a whole huge amount of work. The turning of empty lots into gardens, the turning of empty buildings into useful enterprises, including housing for the community where those empty buildings exist. We have a huge amount of work to be done, but I think that our society is deliberately, especially the bosses of our society, are deliberately excluding that kind of work from being done because they are buying into the notion that work essential for the society's well-being ought to be under the rubric of profit for entrepreneurs.
You just talked about health care, which this past year has been a big issue in the United States, and I've recently come to understand that one of the things Dr. King had been talking about was sit-ins in hospitals, around hospitals until everyone got care. So with that in mind, I'm sure you've been asked this before, but do you think if he hadn't been assassinated when he did, and or the other things which you might mention, what were the things that perhaps slowed the movement, where do you think things might have gone? Do you think some of these battles we're fighting today could have been won 30 or 40 years ago?
The politics of assassination in the 1960s changed our country forever. And I have no doubt that the King assassination was agreed to and planned by major agencies of local and federal government, including probably military intelligence. I suspect that others of those assassinations probably have some of the same footprints behind them, but I've not studied them like I've studied and investigated the King assassination. In any case, that politics of assassination, never publicly discussed, but arranged through covert government in the United States, changed our nation and our history forever. Its biggest handicap, well, I would say two handicaps, two distressful things that happened. One is that when a society, when a people like our people, the nation, the United States, produces young men like John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Medgar Evers and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, who I do not say were perfect products of humanity, but they were people who were emerging in their humanity, in their vision, in their ability to work with society for creative life. When a nation allows such people to be killed off, you do more damage to your nation than you can even imagine. And the people who plotted this, and there were people who plotted it in high and low places, they had every notion concerning domination and control and not benefiting our land. Secondly, that did mean that those assassinations did mean that, number one, the movement of which King had become a symbol, direct action on the part of the people withdrawing their consent from racism and from violence, and the people organizing themselves to put a justice agenda or a freedom agenda in the White House or in Congress or in the governor's mansions. That movement got shortchanged and did not have this opportunity to develop into maturity and to develop into the next generation. It's very clear that all five of these men were learning a great deal about themselves and about their nation. Malcolm X is the most dramatic example of that. But the two Kennedy people had no idea about the meanness in our society, the poverty in our society, that it was all structural before they emerged nationally. And then King and Medgar Evers and Malcolm X had learned a great deal about how to begin to move for change, which meant that on the one side you had folk who were appointed and elected to offices, and the other side folk who were coming out of grassroots mass mobilization and action. A perfect combination for serious change in a nation. And so all of that was destroyed or prohibited, and the good work that had been done to create those five men was aborted, so it has to be done over again. Because obviously we do have a leadership crisis. President Reagan had no notion of the character of this nation. To make him an icon of political righteousness indicates the diseased facet of our nation. For there to have been people who supported and sustained slavery for 250 years is a contradiction to the experiment of 1776. But the point is, we have people who are contorted in their humanity, so they would support tyranny and slavery in the United States for some people of this country. They do not know and do not understand that a nation cannot be half free and half slave. That a democratic society has to become truly an accessible society for all the residents, or it will revert into chaos and tyranny.
Are there any movements right now in 2010 that inspire you or give you hope? We've been talking a lot about, you know, the problems of leadership, the lack of momentum.
The movement for the 21st century has not yet taken shape. There may be creative activity and creative discipline and creative groups coming together on a local level that will one day be the foundation or be the source or be features of the 21st century movement we need. But the 21st century nonviolent movement for the United States is not now in place. It has to get in place. And that's why I stress nonviolence. I mean, I do not understand people who think that it's violence that will bring change. Well, the only change violence brings is devastation to families. And then devastations maybe of the land or the city that is a recipient of the violence. The war in Iraq has not produced any noble ideas for the transformation of human life or the transformation of Iraq. It has led in dividing the human family. It has led in lies, which is always the handicap of violence, which is always the consequence of violence. It has caused the United States with a deficit to, without question, pour a trillion bucks into Afghanistan and almost a trillion in Iraq, without question, and to establish 800 military bases around the world in 130 countries with few Americans even knowing that this is where we've been going. And it's allowed for the emergence of the slavery party to say, we can't afford quality education for the children of our nation. We can't afford Head Start. We can't afford Social Security. We can't afford universal health care. We can't afford affordable housing for the people. We cannot afford jobs for all Americans who want to work and need to work in the world. That's jobs that will enable them to sustain themselves. So we have a whole new slavery party insisting that we can't afford these things, but we can afford 800 military bases around the world. For what purpose? Those 800 military bases, in my mind, and the $1 trillion that we spend on our Pentagon every year, in my mind, represents the abject weakness of the American character. And I maintain that that weakness can be the destruction of American democracy.
I want to challenge you a little bit on what you said. Obviously, you're fierce is the right word, but a proponent of nonviolence. We're here in Mexico, and some of the people you've heard a little bit from some people here who've said, you know, their heroes are guerrilla armies or people who participated in armed revolutions that they feel led to the liberation of their people. To bring it a little closer to the United States, there are stories of slave rebellions. armed slave rebellions where it was not nonviolent, and yet people achieved at least some semblance of freedom. How do you respond to those people who point to examples like that?
Well, in the first instance, my great grandfather was a slave. And anyone who pretends that there were slave revolts that were successful are quite mistaken. There were lots of them, no doubt. There were a lot of other forms of revolt. But the Nat Vesey struggle in around 1830, 1832, the Nat Turner rebellion, development of violence in Virginia in 1930 did not succeed, and almost all the leadership, those are the two best known examples of a slave revolt. And all of the leadership and many innocent people in both Virginia and was it Charleston, South Carolina, or Columbia? I think it was Charleston, South Carolina, were stamped out and wiped out. In the meantime, the Underground Railroad was far more successful in getting people out from under slavery. That's the route my own great-grandfather took. Then secondly, the revolt of people like Frederick Douglass, who as a boy against the law learned how to read, and at different points was even taught by his mistress. The revolt of Owen Brown, who became an accountant on his plantation in South Carolina. The revolt of the people who, in contradiction oftentimes of the wishes of the master, honed their skills so that they could leave or so they could acquire skills that would benefit them in the long run. That was a far greater revolt and did more to free up slaves than did any of the slave revolts. Then thirdly, I'd say that the slaves who said, I'm not gonna let this master convince me I am less than a human being, was another form of revolt. So I think that there is today a revision of the black experience that could be insidious, but I think it's quite wrong. Then there's only, to my knowledge, there's only one guerrilla warfare in Central Latin America that produced serious change, and that was Fidel Castro. Look, Colombia, the units in Colombia have been fighting for 40, 50 years, and it's the people of Colombia who do the suffering, both from the oligarchy and American militarism, as well as from the so-called guerrilla units. And the thing about Fidel Castro is that he did, his people and he did have the skill of organizing in such a fashion that the U.S. Army, in the form of Batista, surrendered and fled. But what is not talked about is that then Castro fundamentally changed his perspective to essentially a nonviolent perspective. He said, I'm going to eradicate racism and segregation. He said, the revolution will eradicate infant mortality rates in Cuba. We are going to eradicate illiteracy. We're going to help people go to work in these fields whereby they can make a living. The only handicap that Castro's Cuba has had has been the antagonism and the overt acts of invasion and assault by the United States government. His government, his people, his Cuba would be a model for the whole world were it not for the United States.
So what does that say then? Does that say, well, violent revolution is okay if you have a really good leader who sticks to his values?
No, I don't think so. I think it says that even if you can develop a violent revolution as Castro did, a military revolution that overthrows the tyrants, if you're going to be effective, you must turn to developing a nation that is whole, that it dismantles the injustices, that tries to educate the people to see themselves as human beings who can excel and who can solve their problems. And what has too often happened with guerrilla warfare is that guerrilla warfare becomes obsessive, like military stuff becomes an obsession, a pathology, no longer has any merit for solving the human condition or healing the human condition. So that's the danger of certain kinds of action, certain kinds of behavior can become so addictive that humans lose control of themselves and are sick and diseased rather than idealistic and practical.
I'm just wondering if it punctures you seem to be saying no, but violence is never okay, and then you're saying, well, in this one case it turned out okay.
No, but I'm saying something more than that the folk who have these notions about the efficacy of violence can only point to a Fidel Castro and that movement. But I'm not saying therefore that was justified. One could even say that maybe Castro's violence is what in turn also then re-triggered American violence. And so it escalated rather than de-escalated. So he lost his chance. And I'm not justifying American violence. I think it's wrong and is serious evil and serious sin. I am saying that people who want a better world had better look at the role of violence, behavioral violence, organized violence, systemic violence, and recognize that in the last 100 years, maybe with the exception of World War II, violence, whether organized in war or informal, is the leading enemy of justice and peace in the world today. It not only devastates in all sorts of ways, it not only has escalated violence, it's not only has escalated the arms race and the militarization of life, but it has also then deprived civilian human enterprises of the resources needed to solve problems. I mean, just for a moment, wonder if all the scientists who have been involved in inventing bombs and weapons of mass destruction and perfecting nuclear bombs, for an example, wonder if that same number of scientists in the world had been working on cancer, working on how we have more sustainable cities, how we can develop more sustainable farms, on how we can use the ocean waters for human uses, on how we can take our garbage and redirect it to being useful. You know, a whole range of human issues. Wonder if that the same numbers of scientists been working on the weapons had been working over the last 40 or 50 years on human situations to see how they could better resolve. is there anybody who doesn't have the good enough sense to recognize you would have a far better world? Wonder if I figured out recently that my nation has probably spent somewhere between 28 and 35 or 40 trillion dollars on the military since World War II. Now wonder if half of that have been used on helping the human race sustain itself with food, or finding ways to stop the pollution of the waters and the air, and moving that in another direction. Wonder if just half of that had been spent on wiping out illiteracy in the world. I mean, it seems to me that this picture of violence is not being artistically sketched anywhere publicly to get people to really see what is going on in their world. Even President Eisenhower in 1959, as he left office, warned that he called it the military-industrial complex. He's the one who created that phrase or used it. But you could call it the military-industrial-scientific-academic complex. Eisenhower said, it was stealing from our children. It was robbing the elderly. And it was, in fact, threatening the very quality of human life.
And one more question about the efficacy of nonviolence. We're almost done here. Some others said, well, you know, in my country here in Latin America, people have tried that and they're getting mowed down by the thousands. It's not working. We're too many people are dying. We need to try something else. What do you tell them?
Well, okay. But if I understand things rightly, the emergence of Hugo Chavez is the emergence, essentially, of a nonviolent approach to politics. And, you know, after all, he didn't just rise up out of Venezuela as a kind of a explosion of a bomb. He has been in his society an organizer of all kinds of people's movements for 20 or 30 years. Eva Morales has been organizing for many years. What's his name in Brazil? Had been on the scene for 30 years trying to organize people for political social change. So what do you do about that? Those are at least three illustrations in the contemporary scene. John Baptiste Aristide of Haiti is another one. And I can't remember the others, but there are a number of others. They all were organizing 10, 20, 30 years before they came to power, on the backs usually of a sizable percentage of their population that saw them as their own spokesperson. So that was not a way of doing it. That was primarily of nonviolent perspective, nonviolent organizing. And that's part of the great hope now in the 21st century that has scared our military intelligence and our White House and our State Department and Pentagon to death in the United States. How many more of those people are going to be raised up?
Want to just get back to the Martin Luther King holiday we hear every year, the same sound bites, I have a dream, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you that a large percentage of what Dr. King stood for is, it's not forgotten, but it's certainly not taught. Anti-war, organizing poor people, and all these other issues. How does that make you feel to see kind of the the very narrow version of the story that's being taught to children and even adults?
I think the problem in the United States is that the white counterparts in the United States for social change and the white counterparts in the peace movement, the labor movement, the justice movement, the educational movement, they are not uniting with the black community to make Martin Luther King's Day a holiday, national holiday, on behalf of justice and human rights. I think that's the problem. It's only a few, as I move around on celebrations, it's not the white people in Los Angeles who say we have to have social change in unions or education or whatnot, who are joining with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Los Angeles to celebrate the holiday. Now, the labor movement in Los Angeles is now doing a much better job of it. But where are the white political figures getting underneath this, helping to plan them, helping to create the holiday in a fashion that will impact the nation or the city? They're not there. That's our biggest problem. The biggest problem is that the so-called white left or progressive community in the United States has divorced itself from seeing King as anything more than a facade and not the movement that he represented, the new foreign policy that he represented, and getting underneath celebrating the holiday in a fashion that makes it an integral part of American history and an integral part of the future struggles.
So you're suggesting the power is actually in the white left, so to speak, and it's not the effect of the racist party, as you referred to it.
The media is always going to domesticate issues in the United States. But here it is. We have a holiday that celebrates the struggle of a people to end Jim Crow law, Jim Crow segregation, poverty, injustice, police brutality, the whole range of it, to paint the Constitution as a Constitution of including all of us. These are some of the things that that movement did. That affects all humankind. Why are not the women's organizations in full support of that holiday? After all, it was the work of the Constitution that, among other things, it said that the Constitution embraces women as well. In the 20th century, initiated by the NAACP. So why are not the women's organizations out there in front trying to organize the celebration around the weekend of King Holiday as a celebration of the progress that we, the American people, have made towards egalitarian society, but of the work that we have yet to do, and thus helping to teach the whole adult society of the efficacy of the King symbolism.
Now, you're still able to speak for yourself at this point, but do you feel that the media and or the white left has done the same to some of your historical work? Do you feel the media or the white left has done the same to some of your historical work, focused it as one thing? And
oh, absolutely. I don't think Nation magazine, which I have read for 50 years, since at least the 1942s, and which I subscribe to still, I don't think Nation magazine has presented a view of America out of a Kingian understanding. His speech on when he decided to make his major speech on Vietnam in a public platform where it would impact the nation and the world, I don't think Nation magazine has paid attention to that speech and is talking about Iraq in that light. King actually said what I said this afternoon. King actually said that if a nation doesn't have a spiritual, moral revolution, then we're going to be protesting for Vietnam this year. He said 10 or 15 years from now, we're going to protest the United States having a war in Central America, South Africa. I mean, that's a clear clear, impactful statement, and I've never seen Nation magazine, to my knowledge, explicate that. They're still talking about the possibility of humanitarian intervention in Darfur. They supported humanitarian intervention in Bosnia. The Bosnia intervention was, in fact, a major plantation capitalism intervention to begin to point those countries and Yugoslavia, the former countries that were united under Yugoslavia, into privatism and neoliberalism and into their version of globalism. And President Clinton was the agent for that. A very messy situation, but I've seen little or none of that in the Nation magazine. Before the Bosnia event and before Iraq, we're still playing the game that United States has responsibility to intervene. Well, when did we get that responsibility? And have we not forfeited that with Vietnam, with Iran, with Iraq, with Guatemala, with Honduras, with Nicaragua? Have we not forfeited our right? The abysmal situations in Mexico, the drug wars and all, have we not forfeited any of our right for any kind of intervention around the world? Well, most people in the world think we have. Yet the Nation magazine, a leading organ for so-called progressive politics, is still talking that crap. How do you handle that? Not a Kingian analysis of foreign policy or militarization or poverty, but that sort of soupy, even wimpy white intellectual analysis, which doesn't say to Exxon and Mobil, you are wrong in Nigeria. You are wrong wanting to control the oil of Central Asia. That oil does not belong to us.
So how do you, I'm asking about you, how do you control the, if you can, the image being painted of you? You're a historical figure, but you're still around to respond. I mean, how do you?
Well, I don't know if I know I get some of this from my family and friends, but I really haven't been out trying to control the views of me. I think there are sufficient numbers of messages that I've done, sufficient numbers of enterprises in which I've engaged in a private and public way, that if people really want to know what I've been about and what I'm doing, they can go and look at and investigate it, you know.
But they're going to be doing the King thing to you someday, if they're not already.
Well, I think there's a lot of stuff out there, but I think they've done that. But I think I'm probably less. I think I'm not probably as good a candidate to domesticate as Martin King has been. For one thing. In the case of Martin King, the family has been in some disarray about his image and continuing mission. So that's a problem. I have three sons in their 40s and a wife. I don't think any of my family are going to be in any kind of dismay over who I am or who I was and what I've tried to do. I don't think I'm going to have this. I have the same family circumstances that has helped to cause this sort of domestication. I don't think it's the major cause. I think the major cause is the way in which the media wants to make Martin King acceptable to plantation capitalism, and he is not.